Back in September 2004, on this very program, I interviewed the then Shadow Minister for Health and the member for Laylaw, Julia Gillard. It was a lengthy and revealing interview at times, and given the events of last week, we thought we should revisit a few of the highlights. She begins the interview by talking a bit about her background.
Well, we're a Welsh migrant, so I always say we're the non-singing Welsh. That's why we had to migrate. No one in my family sings, despite the cultural stereotype.
I might ask you to sing a song then.
not with my voice, no. I think you'd have people turning off in droves. So, my father is from a coal mining village in South Wales called Cwm Grac. My mother is from Barry, which is the port area of Cardiff, the capital of Wales. And like many people of their generation, they decided to migrate to Australia as 10-pound poms. So my sister and I came out here with my mother and father in 1966. We were originally due to settle in Melbourne, but my parents actually met on the boat coming out some Welsh people who had settled in Australia and were on a, had been home for a trip and were coming back to Australia, and they actually lived in Adelaide. So my parents thought, well, the only people we know in Australia are these two people we've met on the boat, so we might as well go to the city they live in. And so we settled in Adelaide.
And did your parents work in hospitals?
Yes, they did. Didn't start out that way. My father actually trained as a psychiatric nurse in South Australia, so that wasn't the background he was from when he was in Wales. But literally after a few years of various jobs in Australia, responded to an advertisement in the newspapers which said, do you want to be a prison guard or a psychiatric nurse? Fill in this application here. And he decided he'd like to be a psychiatric nurse, which took 3 years of training. And he then went on to serve the balance of his working life, 26 years as a psychiatric nurse. And once again, my mother's background wasn't in anything associated with health, but throughout the time that we were in school, she supplemented the family income by being a cook in an aged care facility.
And you were involved in student politics, of course, very successfully. When did you join the Labor Party?
I joined the Labor Party when I was pretty young, so I've been a party member for, it's going back 20-odd years now.
How old were you when you joined?
Oh, God. In late teens, late teens.
Right.
It's a long, long time, before the dawn of time. But, yes, I was went to university in 1979, and for the first year I was at university, really wasn't involved in politics or Labor clubs or anything like that. I was just coming to grips with being at university. And then in the second year I got involved in a campaign against education funding cutbacks. That was, Fraser government and the Philip Lynch Razor Gang, if you can remember all the way back then. And they were pursuing a series of cutbacks to higher education, which I'd have to say by contemporary standards look quite tame, but which we thought were a complete outrage. And that was the first thing I got involved in, and then got progressively involved in the Labor Club and the Labor Party and student unionism at a national level.
Has it ever been hard for you being a woman in the ALP?
Look, I mean, I think the ALP has had a boysy culture. I mean, coming out of, I guess, the trade union movement, out of a working class movement, for a long period of time it had a male ochre kind of culture. And I don't try and pretend that that's completely gone, but certainly during the time I've been involved in the Labor Party, it's been changing, as has the trade union movement itself. So whilst there have been times I think it's been to my disadvantage to be a woman, and there have been times where you'd have to say you're the only woman in the room and the conduct is pretty boysy, most of the time I'd have to say it's not much of an issue these days.
You've been involved in Emily's List, haven't you, which is an effort to change this?
Yes, I have been. The Victorian government fell, when Joan Kerner was defeated as Premier, I think a number of women, including myself, was brought up pretty short by the fact that we thought we'd kind of succeeded and women were equal partners in politics and we'd had a female Premier and female Minister for Health and all of these kind of things. But when we were forced back in the early 1990s in Victoria to kind of our bedrock vote after the stunning sort of defeat, we woke up to find hardly any women left in the Victorian Parliament, and that was, of course, because the women had the marginal seats, not the safe seats. So in the lean times, we went back to being a pretty male outfit, and Emily's List was largely formed out of that experience to say, well, we've got to change this, we've got to make sure that women get a fair share of safe seats, and we've got to make sure that whatever the fortunes of Labor, women are well represented within Labor ranks.
Whenever I go down to question time, I'm struck by the volume of noise you often get there, and some female politicians have told me that it can be a problem, at least at first. I think Margaret Thatcher famously took voice coaching lessons to learn how to lower her tone. Is that something that you've ever had to work at?
I was going to say, I thought, Michael, the next bit of that sentence was going to be the volume of noise that I'm generating personally. No, as you can probably tell from my voice, which stirs up strong opinions either way, I've never been involved in voice coaching, though there have been a number of people who have suggested that I ought to and ought to do so immediately and not utter another word until I had. So I'd have to say, I think I've... it's not exactly dulcet tones, but I think I've got a pretty strong voice, and I think I can hold my own in Parliament no matter what the noise level, and on various occasions have had to. I guess when we step back from that, though, we probably should ask ourselves the question, does it really need to be that kind of place, question time, where the quality of your ability to yell should matter? I think, you know, in a perfect world, it wouldn't be like that. But in the world in which we inhabit, it is. So having a somewhat gravelly voice helps.
That's Julia Gillard on Counterpoint in 2004. Now, at the time of that interview, John Howard still had 3 more years as Prime Minister. Mark Latham was leading the ALP, and Julia Gillard was Shadow Minister for Health. Her previous responsibility had been as Shadow Minister for Population and Immigration, where she produced the ALP's refugee policy. So I asked her if she felt that that was her ideal policy.
Look, I was very proud of it when we finished it. It was a big work, just in terms of volume. It's a sort of 60-page document. It was a bit like writing a PhD thesis. But more than that, of course, it was dealing with policy input from all over the place, and certainly from Labor Party members who were left very emotional and raw after the 2001 election campaign. I think it did balance what we need to balance in our refugee and asylum seeker policy, which is a humanitarian view and a view of our role in a world system which deals with people movement and refugees, but also properly dealing with security issues. So I was proud of it. I think it strikes the right balance, and it was the policy that I wanted to see the Labor Party support, and I was glad when the Labor Party overwhelmingly did.
You're also the Shadow Minister for Reconciliation and Indigenous Affairs at one point. You've obviously had all the easy jobs. Do you reckon we've learned anything important from the past 30 years of white Aboriginal policies?
I think we've learned some things and blindingly failed to learn other lessons, actually. When I had the Indigenous Affairs portfolio, which I only did very briefly, you do see the best of things and the worst of things. There are some people out there who are just doing remarkable things in Indigenous communities, and then there are other places where you go where the sense of despair and hopelessness is overwhelming. What I think we have learned is that it is important to work with Indigenous communities and allow them to show the ability to lead on the best way of delivering programs. And one of the important things that I think has happened in the last few years is the Council of Australian Governments, actually Commonwealth governments, state governments, all of them working together, have created a series of pilot programs where, pilot communities, test communities, where instead of bureaucrats from the Federal Department of Health flying in and doing something, and then bureaucrats from the State Department of Community Affairs flying in and doing something, that the Commonwealth and the state have said, let's cash out the money we would have spent on the sort of programs we would have rolled out and work with the community to try and program the best use of that money here. So I think that sort of process is getting towards the seeds of a solution. So I am enthusiastic about that. At the same time, I'd have to say the stupid rhetorical debate we've got into between symbolic reconciliation and practical reconciliation, I think, has been enormously damaging. To insult people who believe in saying things like sorry by suggesting that they are somehow otherworldly and not interested in practical issues, I think is ridiculous. And to suggest you can solve practical issues without looking at self-esteem, cultural identity questions, I think is misconceived. So a lot of damage has been done through that debate.
What are the main changes you'd like to see in Australia?
Main changes? Well, I'd certainly like to see Australia with a better sense of itself with our Indigenous communities. I think there is much to be done there, not only lifting health and economic and other standards for Indigenous communities, but actually fully integrating our past into our cultural identity and getting rid of the tensions that still remain there. So that's one thing I'd like to see an Australia work through and end up defining for itself. More broadly, the things that brought me into politics are about opportunity for Australians, irrespective of where they started in life, whether they started life as an Indigenous Australian in a remote community, as a migrant, as a kid in the suburbs of my electorate in Werribee Hoppers Crossing. I think giving people access to opportunity, to an ability to make something for themselves by making sure they get good education and good support is really the key. And if I look at my own life, I mean, Mark Latham talks about these things too, and as you've noted, we're the same age. So maybe it's a common experience for people born in 1961. But if I look at my own life compared with my father's life, the thing that has been different between our lives is our ability to access education. My father is as smart as I am, if not smarter, but he left school at 11, having, you know, passed third highest in South Wales in the 11 plus examination, so he could have gone on to secondary schooling, indeed could have gone on with a scholarship, but his family couldn't afford to not have him working, and from that moment on, a lot of the rest of his life, the die was cast. He succeeded in the rest of his life, but succeeded against those odds, not with the benefit of the start that free quality education could have given him. I had completely the reverse experience. I went to great state schools, I got access to university at a time that it was free, and that experience, that ability to go to university, changed my life, and everything that has flowed since has been built on that foundation. And what concerns me, I guess, in today's Australia is it's actually tougher for kids to access the sort of opportunities I had now than when I was accessing them in the 1970s and 1980s.
Something that Conservatives don't always understand, I think, is that Medicare is not just about healthcare, it's got a sort of symbolic, almost social significance for many of us. And I think you once described it as an expression of basic Australian values. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, I have described Medicare that way. I think there's a reason that Medicare has become a cultural and political icon in Australia, if you like. The degree of community attachment to Medicare is above and beyond, a national health insurance system. And I think that's because people, Australians, intuitively accept and want to nurture the sense that we are all in this together. I think people like the democratic sense that it doesn't matter if you're Kerry Packer and you have a heart attack or if you're Fred down the end of the street, that at the end of the day, your ability to survive that experience depends on a quality ambulance response and quality resuscitation in a public hospital. I think we intuitively all get that, and we therefore see Medicare as a sort of expression of how we look after each other, a preparedness to all put in to care for each other in times when it's tough and it's unpredictable and people are at extreme risk. So I think that's what Medicare means to people. It's actually an expression of Australian values about about caring and caring in moments of crisis, and that's why the Australian people have clutched hold of it as firmly as they have, and why even John Howard, who, you know, has hated universal health care throughout his political life, knows that he can't go to an election campaign just stumping up and saying, I'm going to destroy Medicare.
As a politician, you must talk to an enormous number of people. Reflecting on that, what do you particularly like about Australia?
One of the best things I like about it, I do talk to, thousands of people, really. And one of the things that I like best about it is the sense of equality and informality, and I'd have to say larrikinism. It just never ceases to amaze me that people will in Australia barrel up to the Prime Minister, to the Premier of the state. Obviously I'm on the lower pecking order than that, but people like me, and just say, you know, John, I reckon this, Julia, I reckon that. I see school children in Parliament House run up towards the Prime Minister when they're there on visits, and they'll call him John. I see people cluster around Steve Brax at the football in Victoria and they'll call him Steve. And
have you ever been hugged by a sheep?
I've been hugged by a giant kidney. I'm not sure whether or not that counts. Yes, I did get hugged by a giant kidney. And it really is the sense of, you know, larrikinism about it. I mean, one of my favourite campaigning stories is standing out at a street stall in my own electorate on one very windy winter's morning. And when you're campaigning at a street stall, you stand next to a corflute sign of yourself, you know, a big poster sign of yourself. And so there I am, windswept and looking a bit bedraggled, and this old bloke comes out of the supermarket and he looks at me and looks at the sign and looks at me and looks at the sign and then finally says, "Taken on a good day, wasn't it, love?" And you'd have to say, I think that's very Australian, you know, the humour, the upfront, no one's better than you. You wouldn't not say it because it's someone who, you know, you should be treating in a more delicate fashion than that. We're just a very upfront, open, you know, often humorous sort of people, and I reckon that's great. And it actually makes campaigning a pretty robust experience in some senses, because people will come up to you and say anything, but at least it makes it an honest experience too.
Julia Gillard there speaking with me on this very program back in 2004. Since then, she's risen in the pecking order quite some way.